Well, the official clock says we've got a minute, and my cell phone says it's time to start. And so we've already got a full room, it seems like, so I think we might as well start. And so I want to welcome you to session 172, which we have provocatively titled A New Faithful History That Is Faithful to History. And the question before us is how can historians move beyond the critic slash apologist dichotomy that we are also familiar with in this field in order to produce new historical narratives that are honestly informed by what we know, but that are also useful for non-historian believers. And this is a topic of interest to me, and I'm sure it holds a similar degree of interest to all of you here, since we are up against some very strong sessions, and yet we have a very full house. So, although there is more than a little potential for controversy in examining our topic today, I am hopeful that we can sidestep the hard-fought contention over various particular issues, and instead I would like to engage our panel and all of you in a dialogue as if we were all outside consultants giving interested historians advice from theoretical frameworks to practical applications. And to do that, let me describe the format for this session. I'll begin by introducing our panelists, and then I will briefly describe how I have come to this topic and some of my thinking on it. And then next, the panelists will take about 8 minutes each to talk about different aspects of the topic and their own interests in it. Can we close that one door? Okay. And then we'll put questions before the panel, and for the bulk of the session, I want to open it up to a discussion to all of you with the hope of generating some very constructive and positive ideas. And so to begin, let me introduce our panel of experts. And they're sitting out of order from my notes, and so I'm going to... I'll put it in order from... farthest from me to closest. Morris Thurston is a graduate of Harvard Law School who recently retired as a senior partner in the global law firm of Latham & Watkins. Currently, he is a legal editor of the Joseph Smith Papers Project and an adjunct professor at the BYU Law School. His article titled The Boggs Assault and Attempted Extradition, Joseph Smith's Most Famous Case, is pending publication by BYU Studies, and I owe him a map on that, and that's one of the things that's pending. He and his wife, Dawn, have recently authored a book titled Breathe Life into Your Life Story, and they both lecture frequently on the subject of life story writing. Morris is also an avid family historian, basketball player, and a Lakers fan, and many Sunstone folks may know him as Matt's father. John Charles Duffy is a doctoral student in American religious history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. His master's thesis, Faithful Scholarship, The Mainstreaming of Mormon Studies and the Politics of Insider Discourse, won a Lester E. Bush Award for Best Thesis from the Mormon History Association. Also relating to our topic, he recently published in Dialogue, Can Deconstruction Save the Day? Faithful Scholarship and the Uses of Postmodernism. Stephen Taysom earned his PhD in Religious Studies at Indiana University, and he is an instructor at Franklin College in Indiana. He's published on Mormon Topics in Dialogue and Western Historical Quarterly. And Mark Shearer has been World Church Historian for the Community of Christ since 1995. He earned his interdisciplinary PhD in History and Education from the University of Missouri at Kansas City. He's a past president of the John Whitmer Historical Association and also a former council member of the Mormon History Association. And he's currently engaged in writing a new 3-volume history of the Community of Christ entitled The Journey of a People, the first volume covering the era of Restoration, 1820 to 1844, the period that all of the traditions here have in common, is scheduled to go to press this fall. As for me, I'm John Hamer. I'm an independent researcher whose graduate work years ago focused on medieval history and cartography, but for the past decade, I've concentrated my attention on Mormon history, with an emphasis on the histories of the broader movement, the many churches beyond the LDS Church that emerged from Joseph Smith's 1830 Church of Christ. I'm also co-executive director of the John Whitmer Historical Association and editor of John Whitmer Books. And to top it off, I recently joined the Bloggernacle as a contributor to By Common Consent. My own journey began growing up in the LDS Church as a seventh generation Mormon with Kirtland era roots. Although I had no involvement with Mormonism during most of my 20s, and therefore I had no adult experiences, such as an LDS mission or doing temple work, I rediscovered Mormon history when I took an interest in my own family history. And actually, I might say that I discovered rather than rediscovered Mormon history, for although I'd always been interested in history, the Mormon history I encountered as a child in seminary and in the books I had access to was so deadly dull that it failed to spark any interest in me at all. And in fact, the dullness sent me off to study a place that I felt really had history, which was Europe. And so it came as quite a shock to me about 12 years ago when I read a different version of Mormon history, beginning, I guess, inevitably when I picked up a copy of Fon Brody. From that new start, I discovered the massive writings in Mormon history which led me to the Mormon historian community at MHA and JWHA, and I found this community to be so welcoming that I was immediately sucked into its fellowship. And this is a roundabout way of saying that I have roots in the movement as an insider, but I also have lived long enough on the outside to have developed a kind of dual perspective and possibly to act as a translator. About 3 years ago, I was asked to consult on a committee of Community of Christ historians engaged in writing a new, brief, useful history of their church. Their project is planned to be a 100-page book, and it is different from Mark's much more extensive history. Community of Christ members and leaders have been relatively quicker to accept challenges to their traditional understandings of our shared heritage than their LDS counterparts. However, the process of deconstruction has threatened to leave their church without a usable history. The goal of the 100-page book committee is, and it's still not published yet, to produce a new, honest, and useful history for the members. Reading some of the early drafts of this history, my initial reaction to it was that it did not seem very energizing or inspiring. That the history be inspiring, in my thinking, was a big aspect of its usefulness to members. The problem I saw repeated was essentially there had been an original, cherished, foundational story. Historians of the past generation had shown that story as it had been told, wasn't supported by the preponderance of evidence, and so three, the new history explained that story differently, and perhaps even defensively in light of the new understanding. And if we go back to the Mormonism most of you are familiar with, I think this is a general problem in much of what falls under the titles of apologetic or faithful Mormon history. You have a defensive work that reads, sometimes, like a series of negative line items designed to respond to the challenges of critics. And I'm not meaning to suggest that this history is not useful. I spent the last weekend at a blogger retreat for By Common Consent regulars, and I got to spend a lot of time talking to Kevin Barney, who is on the board of FAIR, the apologetic organization, which is holding a conference simultaneous to this one this weekend. And he told me that the goals of their writing were essentially triage and inoculation, which is to say, they want to help believers whose faith is challenged when they encounter criticism of a traditional story by either rebutting the challenge or by helping the believer reinterpret it in a way that does not challenge their faith. And as I told Kevin, I am not trying to suggest that that kind of history doesn't have its place. And from what I've seen, it seems to be a reasonably effective strategy for achieving FAIR's goals. But constantly addressing challenges falls short of the goal I would like to consider because the result can almost read like a double negative. We start, this was the case, that was rebutted with this was not the case, and now we have this was not the case. And when you string those together, it might be faith-saving for those who have encountered challenges, but I don't find it to be inspiring. And I was talking to my friend Craig Foster, who comes down on the apologetic side and wanted to pin me down for an example. I've been a little nebulous in all of this, and so he came up with one himself. A few years ago, we had the anniversary of the William Martin Handcart Companies, and apparently, this is just a story from Craig, President Hinckley, in commemorating the event, told the story in a traditional way, which ended on the point that none of the survivors ever left the LDS Church. And at some point, a faithful LDS historian sent him a correction indicating that we do know that some of them did actually leave. A correction which President Hinckley ignored as he continued to tell it the traditional way. And the problem, it was or is that any member who heard the story told that way from the prophet's lips and then later encounters evidence that survivors left the church might decide that they were deceived, and they might even leave themselves. And so Craig's solution would have been to correct the original, saying most of the survivors stayed with the church. And that change would make the story accurate. But the correction also makes the claim defensive. And in this case, I think it robs it of any point. And so why do you mention that at all? I mean, I would imagine that the reader would have the expectation that most of the people would stay. So this isn't to say that we can't look at the Martin and William Martin Hancock pioneers and find accurate stories that are heroic and inspire us, but we can't necessarily just patch the traditional stories and have hope that we can make do with debunking. If we get back to the 100-page history, as I tried my hand to this challenge, I found that this goal was a lot more easily said than done. And so I'm here today as a latecomer to this problem, entering a conversation that has been ongoing among Mormons for a long, long time. And I'm not trying to suggest that historians shouldn't challenge foundational narratives or that other historians shouldn't try to answer challenges. But I'm hopeful that in this session, while this work is ongoing, those of us who are interested can come up with strategies to build a useful history that is existing beyond the current battle lines. Not all the members of the panel we've assembled are engaged in this this enterprise personally, but I've asked them to come and to think about this problem and to give us advice as if they were consultants. And so first off, we'll have John Charles give us his take on the background of Mormon studies theory since Mormon history began to be professionalized, from the underpinnings of the New Mormon history to the framework underlying the newer Faithful History Project. Next, Mark will give us insight into the dual role he plays as a church historian, the ministerial and the scholarly, and his insights for maintaining what is often a very delicate balance. He can also tell us the practical approaches he's used and the lessons he's learned while writing his own history of the Community of Christ. Then Morris will talk to us about the Joseph Smith Papers Project of the LDS Church History Department and the shift that department has had to the idea of publishing a wealth of primary documentation rather than, during the New Mormon history, the multi-volume secondary history of the church. He can also tell us the practical approaches he's used and the lessons he's learned while writing his own. I skipped paragraphs there. He can also share with us the strategies he uses in his own work for avoiding critic apologetic polemics and also for making stories come alive. And finally, Steve will talk to us about general religious studies approaches to history, including the usefulness and limitations of the approach of letting religious visionaries speak in their own words. And he will also describe strategies used by religious scholars from other faith traditions. And I'm going to keep them all to 8 minutes because there are a lot of people here who also, I think, want to have questions and comments. And so we'll have, a great discussion.
This panel is asking about the possibility for what it calls a new faithful history. My task here is to offer some historical perspective on where that question comes from. What was the old faithful history? How did we get to the point where now people are asking about a new faithful history? And what is the political context in which this discussion is taking place? I should add here that I'm going to be talking about the LDS context, not the Community of Christ context, A, because I don't know the Community of Christ context so well, and B, what I do know about it indicates, as John has also said, that it has followed a very different trajectory from what I'm going to map out here for the LDS context. So where does the term faithful history come from? That term was enshrined into LDS parlance in 1969 by an article that Richard Bushman published in Dialogue titled Faithful History. Bushman had, at the time he published this article, recently won the Bancroft Prize, which is probably the most prestigious award given in American history, for work he had done not related to Mormon history. In this article, Faithful History, Bushman complained that LDS historians were guided more by secular professional values than they were by their faith. Secular histories, Bushman said, represent themselves as objective. But in fact, he continued, there is no such thing as objectivity. Why then, he asked, should we not replace secular presuppositions with what he called the more penetrating insights of our faith? Bushner explained that he was suspicious of people who emphasized the human side of church history, because in his experience, he said, those people tend to think that the church is only human and does not have a divine side. He asked whether we weren't, in fact, better off back in the days when Mormon historiography was torn by polemics of pro versus anti-Mormon. At least in those days, he said, the question of authenticity had been front and center. Now, what was Bushman responding to? In the 1960s and 70s, there was an expansion of higher education in the United States, which brought an increased number of Latter-day Saints into the professions, and in turn led to an increase in professional historical work on Mormonism. The dominant approach during that period, the 60s and 70s, was very different from what Bushman was advocating. This approach came to be referred to as the New Mormon History, a term which was coined, incidentally, or at least appeared in print, in the same year that Bushman introduced the term Faithful History. The New Mormon History was represented most prominently by Leonard Arrington and Thomas Alexander. Arrington, of course, was the first professionally trained church historian for the LDS Church. Thomas Alexander was a BYU history professor who became the New Mormon History's leading apologist. The New Mormon History can be characterized as follows. It tried to build common ground with non-LDS scholars. As Arrington once put it, they were trying to understand Mormonism as scholars of any faith or no faith would understand. It was trying to be objective, by which they meant they were trying to transcend the old anti versus pro-Mormon polemics. They were trying to find a middle ground between traditionalists who wanted faith-promoting history and secularists who were trying to debunk Mormon claims. They saw themselves as taking religious claims seriously. However, third point, the New Mormon History also tried to sidestep questions about the objective reality of Mormonism's supernatural claims. They were trying to bracket those questions. And one way they tried to do this was to be neutral in their language. They would use qualifiers. They would say things like, Joseph said that he saw God the Father and Jesus Christ. Or the Book of Mormon was reportedly translated from golden plates. They saw this as trying to be neutral about the claims. This approach to Mormon history had its high point during Leonard Arrington's tenure as church historian in the 1970s, which is the period many people remember as Camelot. That approach to Mormon history very quickly fell into disfavor. How did that happen? In the 1970s, histories produced by Leonard Arrington's History Division were criticized by church educational system instructors and by a trio of apostles, Ezra Taft Benson, Mark E. Peterson, and Boyd K. Packer, who felt that these histories were not adequately faith-promoting. They focused too much on the human side. They were sowing doubt in the minds of young members. This led to the History Division being shut down and Arrington being released as church historian. And I think officially he's like expunged from the record. He's not considered a church historian. The nail in the coffin to all of this was that Boyd K. Packer gave his now famous address, The Mantle is Far, Far Greater Than the Intellect, in which he said that you cannot write an objective history of the Mormon movement without affirming its supernatural claims, because those supernatural claims are objectively real. He also said, we are at war with evil, and historians are obligated to defend the church's interests in that war. They must not give airtime to the enemy. We know, he said, that church leaders are human. We don't need historians to tell us that. We need historians to show us that they are prophets. Now, in the 1980s, a new kind of challenge developed. BYU political science professors Louis Midgley and David Bohn, who were joined later by people like Daniel Peterson and William Hamblin, who made similar critiques, raised objections that were similar in essence to Packer's objections, but were in a much more philosophically sophisticated language. They used postmodern critiques of the ideal of objectivity, as these were being articulated in the mainstream academy, to challenge this idea that the New Mormon historians had that you could be objective. This debate, which became to be known as the Mormon History Wars, got very personal, very intense, and by all accounts, very ugly. People like Mitchell and Bone accused New Mormon historians like Leonard Arrington and Thomas Alexander of being positivists, which was a devastating accusation, religiously and professionally. Religiously, because it suggested they didn't believe in spiritual realities, and professionally, because it suggested they were behind the times and were kind of out of tune with contemporary theory, which was actually true. Now, religiously speaking, however, this was probably an unfair accusation, but there is anecdotal evidence to suggest that some people associated with the New Mormon History movement were moderately liberal, meaning that they questioned Book of Mormon historicity or the need for historicity. Some of you are laughing, but you know. I say they're moderately liberal, but maybe you have different ideas about that. Arrington was actually quite clear about this. In 1985, he gave, Sunstone published a paper of his, which I believe had begun as a Pillars of My Faith talk, in which he admitted very frankly, and in retrospect, this was a very unwise thing to do, that he didn't need Mormon claims to be historical. He was prepared to accept the church as true whether or not the Book of Mormon was historical or not. It is unthinkable now to imagine a church historian for the LDS Church making that claim. Now, there's a larger context here. In the early 1980s, the Hoffman forgeries emboldened people who were criticizing the historicity of LDS faith claims. And this led to a much more radical claim to historicity than the New Mormon history had produced. Instead of just sidestepping or bracketing those kinds of claims, you began to see people emerging, George Smith, Brent Metcalf, Dan Vogel, who were explicitly denying the historicity of these claims. These people came to be known as revisionists. And it's probably fair to say that they were positivists. They appeared, however, as part of an even larger radicalizing trend in Mormonism. For example, the emergence of a very assertive brand of feminism, growing out of the ERA controversy, and the emergence of gay advocates, which set the stage then for Boyd K. Packer's famous early 1990s address, where he warned that feminists, gays, and intellectuals, by whom he probably meant revisionists, were the three great threats that the church faced. Now, in response to this threat, new apostles, Neely Maxwell, Dallin H. Oaks, both of whom had university backgrounds, at least university administration, and who valued intellectualism more than people like Benson, Packer, or Peterson, began to encourage scholars at BYU, scholars with farms, scholars with the Smith Institute, scholars at religious education, to develop scholarship that would defend the church from its enemies. In an address in the late 1980s, Maxwell praised faithful scholars, he called them, who were helping to establish the authenticity of Mormon claims. That term, faithful scholars, and the associated term, faithful scholarship, very quickly came into vogue in Mormon usage. By the 1990s, there was then a new orientation, which we could call faithful scholarship, which used the methods of the professional disciplines. They were not anti-intellectual, like earlier critics of the new Mormon history had been. And in fact, the faithful scholars were themselves critiqued by people within CES who thought they were too intellectual. But they were still committed to LDS orthodoxy, very clearly and assertively so. That orientation marginalized all others in the 1990s, largely for institutional means. Namely, the church enforced orthodoxy on LDS scholars through things like the Strengthening Church Members Committee, the September 6th Communications, the St. Mount Symposia, the BYU Academic Freedom Controversy, and the incorporation of farms into BYU as a kind of stamp of approval on that organization's faithful scholarship approach. Important LDS institutions, BYU, BYU Studies, the Smith Institute, farms, incorporated what I've elsewhere called a perspectivalist rhetoric in defining their mission and committed them to working from a distinctively LDS perspective in their scholarship. In other words, the faithful history was the opposite of the New Mormon history, where the New Mormon history tried to understand Mormonism as scholars of any faith or no faith would understand. The faithful history was explicitly committed to representing an LDS perspective on these issues. Where the New Mormon history had tried to be objective, to operate in kind of a middle ground, the faithful history rejected that possibility. You could not be objective. They were decidedly committed to defending LDS interests. Where the New Mormon historians had used qualifiers, the faithful historians rejected those qualifiers. They did not want to use terms like reportedly or ostensibly in reporting LDS faith claims. Richard Bushman and Terrell Givens are two examples of scholars who have done this very prominently, who have avoided using those qualifiers. Now, what's happening in the 2000s? In the 2000s, Mormon studies begins to move into the academic mainstream in a way it had not done before. Chairs being established in institutions, courses, conferences at places like the Library of Congress and Yale. And an intriguing development happened. As LDS scholars increasingly began to interact with non-LDS scholars, and therefore began to need to find common ground, faithful scholars began to make moves that were reminiscent of the New Mormon history. Example, in 1969 and then again in the early 2000s, Richard Bushman asked, wouldn't it be better to plant the question of authenticity squarely before readers? Make them, force them to decide whether Joseph Smith actually had golden plates or not. But Bushman didn't do that himself in Red Stone Rolling. I've been told, by the way, from something Lou Midgley has written recently, that Bushman now regrets having not done that. But if he hadn't done it, it's very unlikely that Knopf would have published the book. Another example. In the early 2000s, the National Institute for the Humanities gave the Smith Institute a grant to host a summer seminar on Joseph Smith. Grant Underwood, who's a BYU historian, touted that grant as a sign that the NIH trusted BYU to study Joseph Smith without bias. A few years later, Richard Churdy and his co-authors on the New Mormon Mountain Meadows Massacre book insisted that they did not have an agenda in their writing. They were willing to follow the evidence wherever it went. In other words, these faithful scholars were professing objectivity. They were professing to be able to bracket off their own presuppositions, their own prior commitments. Now, when people like Leonard Arrington and Thomas Alexander talked about doing that, people like Lou Midgley stood up and denounced them. It's epistemologically impossible to do that. You're betraying the faith by doing that. But when faithful scholars make those moves to try to gain credibility from the outside, all of a sudden, LDS perspectivalists fall strangely silent. Another example. In the introduction to his book, Believing History, his collection of essays, Richard Bushman describes himself as standing on a middle ground between, on the one hand, traditionalists who want purely faith-promoting history, and on the other hand, secularists who attack Mormonism. That effort to claim a middle ground is exactly what Thomas Alexander was doing in trying to defend the New Mormon history. When Richard Bushman makes that move, no one complains. Which brings us to today's session. The abstract for this session talks about, let me find it here real fast, trying to transcend the divide between critics and apologists. I live in 2001, Stephen Tatum gave a paper at a Smith Institute symposium where he talked about doing a new faithful history, which would do that, which would transcend the old divide between traditionalists and critics, which would try to tell stories that were not trying to be either pro or anti-Mormon.
Didn't work.
We've heard all this before. This is exactly what the New Mormon history was trying to do. And it was slapped down for doing it by the people who became advocates of what we now call the faithful history. But what's the difference between the New Mormon history and this hope for a new faithful history? Two differences, and then I'll stop. One, even though what Taysom advocated represented a revival of the New Mormon history's search for middle ground, Taysom was very careful to call it faithful history. He had to call it faithful history. The intellectual politics of Mormonism have reached a point where if you're going to operate within LDS institutions as a historian, you have to call what you're doing faithful. Second, maybe. It may be that people like Taysom are more definitely committed to the historicity of LDS faith claims than people like Arrington were. That would be a difference with the New Mormon history. And in any case, they had better be more committed to the historicity of LDS faith claims, if they intend to successfully navigate the intellectual politics of Mormonism. Because the events of the 1990s made very clear that the church is willing to punish scholars who do not embrace the historicity of LDS faith claims. And I have yet to see evidence that that situation has changed.
I let him go over, but I just wanted to hear it all. That was great. You.
Stay on that. Stay on.
Well, I'm very pleased to be able to present on this panel and to share some thoughts about my role as the Community of Christ World Church historian, but also as a Graceland University Associate Professor of History. And I'm here to tell you that it is possible to wear both hats simultaneously, but it has to be adjusted correctly. A challenge to be sure. I'm also didn't print out my notes. I printed them out, but then I changed them at the last minute, so now I'm having to read this off my computer because I like this version a little bit better. First, I want to share some thoughts about how I interpret the discipline of history, then make some recommendations on how to address this deconstruction apologetics dialectic that we find ourselves in. And then I want to conclude with some thoughts about how to look forward as a historian. Because I think that's very, very important. So that may be kind of an aside, but it'll be interesting, hopefully. The study of history has its limits, especially in the realm of religious history. It's difficult for historians to ultimately verify or disprove the mystical, spiritual, or revelatory experiences that birth, sustain, or transform religious movements. Faith and beliefs are impacted by our history, but they're not limited to that history. Ultimately, the foundation and continuing source for our faith is God's revelation in Jesus Christ. Now, with that said, The community of Christ is currently exploring issues related to identity, mission, and message, and we've heard some of that this afternoon earlier. The community of Christ leadership affirmed that it is essential to the health and future of the institution that a church story be written that reflects historical integrity. Now, in the context of what we just heard about faithful history as opposed to other history, it'll be interesting to see what kind of reaction we find here. We want to make sure that we're getting the story straight and right, or at least as right as we can based upon the most accurate readings of past events. The challenge is to avoid pronouncing a particular work of history as the one and only true account. That's not any more acceptable to the community of Christ than the beliefs in being the one and only true church. Such an approach to creating an only true narrative runs perilously close to canonizing a version of history, a tendency which we in the community of Christ have demonstrated in the past. This inclination is hazardous because it shuts the door to additional insights that may emerge in the future. This, we know, violates the historian's task. So, I believe there's wisdom in the community of Christ's long-standing policy that it does not legislate nor mandate positions on matters of church history. The community of Christ's first presidency has affirmed that historians should be free to come to conclusions as they feel are proper after thorough consideration of documents and artifacts to which they have access. The community of Christ encourages people to explore church history with openness, including respectful dialogue with those who have varied viewpoints. Doing so allows people to draw conclusions based upon how they weigh the evidence. Now, that comes right off the community of Christ website, if you would like to refer to that further. Now, my thoughts. The discipline of history is not a science, but it's an art. Historians create their work through scholarly research and then paint, through the use of narrative, a picture of events as they can best understand them. This task would be much easier if the historian could omnisciently experience all events as they actually happened, which of course we know is virtually impossible. To address this, the English historian Robin G. Collingwood suggested the application of, and this is important, historical imagination. I repeat, historical imagination. Writing religious history requires imagination. So let us take Collingwood's suggestion and imagine, if you will, now, you have to use your imagination here. We're all going to be historians. I want you to imagine a 10,000-piece puzzle on a large table. You got that pictured in your mind now? All the pieces are all scrambled around. Well, you spend a lifetime putting the pieces together. And when assembled, the puzzle represents a picture that we're going to call the church story. Now, although most pieces fit together neatly, and we celebrate that when they do, there are some pieces that simply don't fit. Now, to remedy the incongruities, historians of earlier generations did their best to simply force the pieces into position, even though clearly, they did not. They didn't fit. Today, through sound historical methodology, instead we study carefully why the pieces don't fit. When we arrive at an answer, we fashion a new puzzle of the same church story. And this is what we call deconstruction, but also reconstruction. Unfortunately, many in earlier generations, including many of the Community of Christ church leaders, embraced this puzzled story as an important component of their faith testimony. Indeed, for many of them, their history had become their theology. Unfortunately, deconstruction created a faith crisis, because in reconstructing the story changed. So herein lies the problem. How do we continue to promote the old picture, knowing that their concretized faith will be affirmed, or do we ease members into understanding that the picture narrative has changed? I think you know my view on this. So how is this to be done? How do we create a faithful history while also being faithful to the discipline of history? Well, I can name this tune in four notes. Let me take a shot. First, we need to make some admissions about the historical enterprise. What, in that truth is elusive. What is considered facts today may well change over time. The Hispanic historian George Santayana has said that almost all history is written wrong, which is why you have to continually rewrite it. We must understand what historians can and cannot authoritatively write. Historians, as I said at the outset, cannot verify a person's faith testimony. For example, and this has happened to me as church historian, if someone testifies that they had an encounter with the three Nephites, what am I supposed to say? All I can say is that this is what the person testified to. I cannot say that it actually happened. I wasn't there. I wish I would have been. Finally, a historian is not a theologian. We have a difficult time professionally discussing faith issues. Personally, I'm very happy to bequeath such responsibility to my good friend Tony Shavala Smith, who is the Community of Christ theologian in residence. I'm not sure how well he likes my emails, but I'm very happy to bequeath that to him. The problem is that historians then, in the minds of some, become unfaithful. I can assure you that my testimony of Jesus Christ is a vibrant one. I'm not so sure everybody believes that, though. But it's because of my commitment to honest history. My hope is that my honesty will testify to my integrity as a minister. That's one of the hats that I wear. Second, we must take great care in choosing our wording and phraseology. It's very easy to destroy a person's faith with abrasive and judgmental writing. This approach is very important to me. My task is, in fact, ministerial in nature, but that ministry cannot be compromised with history that is not truthful, at least as best as I can understand it. And also, as we deconstruct the story, we must also reconstruct one that is more reliable. You can't leave the puzzle just strewn on the floor. That's irresponsible history, in my opinion. Third, speaking of reliability, we must use reliable sources in our research. Tainted resources begats tainted historical interpretation. There are many examples of historical works that, in my opinion, had great potential to add significantly to our understanding of the church story, but because they used faith promotion research sources, at least in my mind, it resulted in great disappointment. We need to stick to the original documents and documentary histories as much as we can. And then when we read secondary sources, we have to understand the author's agenda. I'll wind up here. He told me he was going to do that. Okay. Let me jump ahead here. Finally, we need to realize the value of historical imagination. I would place greater emphasis on a healthy imagination than even R.G. Collingwood did. Indeed, I believe a healthy imagination is God's gift to the historian. My imagination is my envisioning tool, and it can be used viciously if not taken care of. So, in conclusion, the responsible historian of religion walks a tightrope, to be sure. That rope stretches out over the crevasse of historical credibility, and it's very easy to slip and fall, losing all. To make it safely to the other side requires excellent professional training, personal commitment, and support of friends and family when the criticism comes. And believe me, it comes. Finally, the journey of religious historians' tightrope requires the ability to resist temptation to look down. Rather, sound history requires a bolstered faith by looking forward. Thank you.
Yes, well, see, I have a real technical glitch because I have this great PowerPoint that I intended to show there, but I can't have my computer over there because I have to read it, and my remote is lost. So there's just a lot of problems. Anyway, you don't get the PowerPoint, but you get the stuff. I would like to start by saying that what I'm going to talk about in this little segment here is the Joseph Smith Papers. But I have a great interest in this subject because I think as a lawyer and as a trial lawyer for 35 years, who's tried a great deal of high-profile cases, I really have had a chance to see this element of truth and what truth really means. And I'd like to talk about that maybe a little bit later. But for now, the Joseph Smith Papers are an interesting development in the LDS Church historical office. A disclaimer, I am an editor of those papers. I'm on the legal aspect of the papers. There's going to be some devoted to that. I'm not a church history employee. I'm able to do this. I don't need to be paid for it, and that suits me very well. And I work from California mostly, where I live, although whenever I get up to Utah, I go in there and attend meetings and things. So what I'm telling you, I'm not as well qualified as Ron Esplin, who's heading up the project. I hope that what I say is accurate. I think it is. I've researched it. I may not be able to answer every question, but I'll do my best. Ron Esplin, who is the managing editor, indicated that the purpose of the project is to make available complete and realistic texts of all surviving Joseph Smith documents. And I've got that highlighted on my screen. All surviving Joseph Smith documents, and present them with supporting context and other details that help make them as intelligible to modern readers as they would have been to the participants in the history they document. So if that goal could be realized, what a wonderful boon it would be to current day historians. Now, what papers are covered by this project? Well, there's several series that will be published. One is called the Journal Series, and they consist of the journals and diaries that Joseph himself kept, or were kept for him by his scribes. And as many of you may know, most of his journals and diaries were kept by scribes. A small percentage were in his own hand. The Documents Series will consist of the correspondence that Joseph had with and from other people, revelations, discourses, editorials, etc., the actual original documents. All of these things will be transcribed and typed out, so they'll be very accessible and readable. The History Series will be a complete rendition of the original pioneer manuscript history of the church that left Nauvoo and went back to Salt Lake without the edits that occurred later as B.H. Roberts and others tried to put together other and additional details. The Revelation and Translations series will include texts of the revelations or translations that were received or produced by Joseph Smith. And by texts in plural, we mean not only those that originally came out of his pen, but the changes that may have occurred over time. The legal and business series that I'm involved in are the records of court cases involving Joseph Smith and records of business entities in which he was involved, and I'll talk a little bit about that later. And then finally, the administrative series are the records pertaining to church institutions that reflect Joseph Smith's personal involvement. Now, as you probably can see, these aren't papers, these aren't every historical document that ever was produced in the early church history. If, for example, Parley P. Pratt wrote a letter to Orson Hyde, that wouldn't be a Joseph Smith document. But with that limitation, with the limitation that we're talking about Joseph Smith documents, this promises to be a very full and interesting resource for historians or amateur historians or anyone that just would like to get back and see what was put down originally. Some of the features that will be included, each volume is going to have an introduction that will give the historical context of that. An introduction to each document will be there, explaining what it is and how it came to be. Source or provenance notes, how did we get the document, where did it come from, how certain are we that it's genuine. Detailed textual annotations and footnotes. So as you read along, if you're reading about something that is a little unclear, and very often these original documents are, because after all, they weren't writing to us, they were writing to the people that were there at the time, there will be footnotes that explain who is this person he's talking about, where is this place that he's mentioning. Historical annotations, biographical directories, we'll have at the back little biographies of all the principal participants, geographical directories explaining where the geography took place, a lot of towns are mentioned that no longer exist, where were those, we'll hopefully say, glossaries of terms, illustrations, newly rendered maps, and we've asked John is one of the people, a wonderful map maker, who's going to prepare some maps for that, a chronology covering each volume so that you can kind of see how it all fits, and a comprehensive index. And in the back of each of the printed volumes will be a DVD that will contain additional material. Sometimes you'll find documents that are just repetitive. 50 promissory notes that are basically in the same language. We won't put all 50 in there. We'll put one, and then in the back, though, we'll have on the DVD all 50 if you want to take a look. The administration, Elder Jensen, as Marlon Jensen, as the church historian, is in charge of it, the overall charge, but others include Rick Turley, Ron Esplin, and there's a national advisory board of several well-known individuals, some of whom are not Mormons, and it has been endorsed by the National Historical Publications and Records Commission, and it'll be published by the Church Historians Press, which is a new imprint that has been produced for just this purpose. I won't go into the various editors, but you will, if you're interested in Mormon history, you will have read books by many of them. They've all very scholarly individuals. I'm sure most of them fit into the category that John Paul would say are faithful historians, but nevertheless, historians who spend a lot of time looking at these things and have published. Esplin said, in reference to the legal series, unraveling obscure references, trying to understand unusual settings, and exploring long-forgotten history has taken us into many nooks and crannies, shedding light on things we didn't understand well before. Nowhere is this more true than with the legal series. Our legal experts are, perhaps for the first time in 100 years, coming to really understand the prevailing law in the jurisdictions where Smith functioned. Only now have we come to appreciate the extent of his legal entanglements. Nearly 200 times before magistrates, plaintiff, or defendant, and the time and resources these demanded. And it really is quite amazing to me that this multitasking man was able to handle these legal matters at the same time he was doing all of the other things. The legal series will consist of 3 volumes, New York and Ohio being one, the Missouri period another, and the Illinois period another. And there are 4 editors, Gordon Madsen, Jeff Walker, Joe Bentley, and myself. There's a great deal of care going into the editing of these documents. Every document will be first taken from a high-resolution scan of the original that can be blown up on a computer screen, and great detail can be seen for each little pen stroke, and that will be typed out by someone who's an expert in that. The second level review will be by the editor, such as myself, where we'll do a blind reading of it. We will take the original document, and we will read it, and someone else who hasn't typed it will read the typed version word for word. And if there's a disagreement, we try to work that out and make sure we get the right word in there. Finally, if there are any disagreements that seem a little bit iffy to both of us, it'll go to an expert in the third level review who is specifically trained in these matters and will have a good overall picture of things. And then, of course, there's the typical editing and proofreading that goes into producing the book. Eventually, the plan is to publish all of these papers on the Internet. There's been some question about whether that might be done, but it will be. It won't be right away. The publishers want a period of time. I guess it's like a DVD coming out after the movie's been released. They want a period of time where there's an incentive to buy the books to recoup the printing costs. But eventually the hope is that they'll all be there and accessible on the Internet. The project website, you can even go to it right now and see a lot of this, www.josephsmithpapers.org. This is very similar in the manner in which it's being handled to what's called the Founders Online Project. And one of the criticisms that some people have made, and frankly one of the frustrations I have had, is the slow pace that this has taken. And it's taken many years, and they're hoping that the first two volumes will be published sometime late this year. But they're not going to come out all at once by any means, and there's going to be... Okay, I'll wind it up. There's going to be 20 to 30 volumes that come out, and the various founders, from George Washington to Benjamin Franklin, I'll just give you an example of Washington, 60 of 90 volumes have been published so far, but it was started in 1968 and is expected to end in 2023. So this is not something that you do overnight. I hope that everyone will be patient. I really do feel that for a historian, having these matters, these documents, will enable them to take it further. It is not the goal of the papers to interpret them. I don't think that's something that can be done under direct church supervision. This has to be done by historians trained. But hopefully, this will make the resources available to historians. Thanks.
I was a little terrified to hear John Charles reference that paper that I wrote, which really represents a graduate student in his very first year falling in love with what he thinks is postmodernism. But that article had an interesting life, because when it was going through the process of peer review, I got one back that said, reject, submit to dialogue. Another said, reject, submit to BYU studies. So I figured I'd done something right or something very wrong. But I'm just going to kind of lay out briefly some of the religious studies approaches to faith and scholarship. And there's lots. When I went to graduate school at Indiana University, I didn't know anything about this. I thought, yeah, there's good scholarship and there's not good scholarship. And I know I do good scholarship because I read Sunstone. And the people who don't know what we're talking about. And my advisor, Stephen Stein, sort of suggested that I visit the library, and I did. And I found out that there's this entire debate that's been going on for hundreds of years almost about this. But because I was swamped in the particularities of Mormonism, I had been so focused on this that I hadn't seen or been exposed to these larger structural arguments. And there are three basic approaches. There are actually more than that, but the number is inversely related to the temperature in this room. And so now there are three. Okay? The first way that you can approach this is to change expectations and definitions. This is evident, for example, in the work of John Dominic Crossan. In the work, he writes about the historical Jesus and early Christianity. And Crossan, he's part of the Jesus Seminar, and most conservative religionists would say he was, you know, a heretic and certainly destined for hell. But he writes morally charged history. And he says the resurrection of Jesus is a myth, but it's important because they made it up. And things that are made up are more important than things that actually happened, because it tells you what people are believing in. They actually took the time to make it up. And you can draw a moral for your own life out of it. Okay? So that's one example of changing expectations and definitions. This tends to happen when religions mature to a point where there are lots and lots of approved or semi-approved ways of thinking about foundational texts. And this takes a very long time. In other words, there have to be a lot of liberals. The second approach, the one that I think most religious studies scholars use, is to divide epistemologies or bracketing. You know. So when we come into this arena, we all have to agree on certain rules. And this is what's really important. It's not the particularity. The case shouldn't matter. It's what the rules are. We have to agree on them before we get into the arena, which presents all kinds of problems. And one of the things that grew out of this was a phenomenological approach, or letting the sources speak for themselves. Now, that should have elicited a laugh, right? Sources do not speak for themselves. They don't. They never have. And what's interesting is we only want sources to speak for themselves if they're saying things we like. And so when I teach this to my students, I introduce something called the Jim Jones test. Because when they want sources to speak for themselves, it's always the founders of their faith. And so I say, let's talk about Jim Jones. And they say, who's Jim Jones? And I say, let's talk about David Koresh. And then maybe now it's Warren Jeffs. But the point is, you find someone that you know they're going to find repugnant. And you say, do you want to let them speak for themselves? And they say, why would I want to do that? And I say, you have to decide on the methodology. Then you look at the particulars. Because you can't have this kind of incoherent approach. And I was heavily influenced by Thomas Alexander when I was at BYU. And he favored this approach. You know, if there's a supernatural story, it's just like any other story. You just report it as it's, you know, in the source. But I came to be more sympathetic to an approach championed by Russell McCutcheon and Bruce Lincoln, which is far from what I wrote in the piece that John Charles advocated. And McCutcheon, who's sort of the grumpy old man of religious studies, wrote a book called Critics, Not Caretakers. And his argument was that even in modern times, the American Academy of Religion and other scholarly groups that are dedicated to the scholarly subject of religion have been kind of subtly trying to sneak Protestant theology in. And he said, it's not our job to be caretakers of religion, it's our job to be critics of it. And the argument is that religion and scholarship are systematically incompatible. But I want to, this is a terrible thing to do to you, I'm going to read a very brief snippet from something very important, Bruce Lincoln's thesis on method. Absolutely required reading for any graduate student in religious studies. And this is what he writes. I'm going to read pieces of two of these theses on method. Religion is that discourse whose defining characteristic is its desire to speak of things eternal and transcendent with an authority equally transcendent and eternal. History, in the sharpest possible contrast, is that discourse which speaks of things temporal and terrestrial in a human and fallible voice while staking its claim to authority on rigorous critical practice. History of religions is thus a discourse that resists and reverses the orientation of that discourse with which it concerns itself. To practice history of religions in a fashion consistent with the discipline's claim of title is to insist on discussing the temporal, contextual, situated, interested, human, and material dimensions of those discourses, practices, and institutions that characteristically represent themselves as eternal, transcendent, spiritual, and divine. So McCutcheon and Lincoln say these two things don't mix. And if you're either a critic or a caretaker, there's a middle ground. And this is argued for by a number of scholars, most recently in the Journal of the American Academy of Religion by Michael Satlow, who is Jewish and a scholar of Judaism. And he argues that there is more nuance required here, that there are such things as first and second order definitions. First order definitions are those definitions that a group of practitioners applies to itself. Assuming, of course, the myth that there's one group, okay, that they all think alike. Second-order definitions are definitions that scholars apply to those groups. They can criticize it. And he argues that you can be both. You can, in your life, believe in first-order definitions. And you can, as a scholar, switch hats and apply second-order definitions. The criticism is that's dishonest. My point is, and this is all I'm going to introduce you to because I think that's sufficient. No matter how we talk about this, there are lots and lots of intricacies. Forgetting the particularities and speaking just on the structure of the problem, because this is contested. People care about this. And people care about lots of things, but we all know people really care about this, right? And so if I'm a consultant, I'm going to tell you there are lots and lots of potholes and traps and philosophical issues with which we must be familiar. And that's going to require some study before we can just decide, okay, here's how we write it so we satisfy everybody. Because, well, you're never going to do that. Okay.
Well, I think we have a really exciting and diverse panel that we can use, I think, now to come up with ideas. And I also want to engage all the audience. We don't have one of the little line things. People can grab those. And if people want to be in order and stand up and come to them and ask questions. But what I really would like to... I've written out a bunch of questions, too, because I want to engage all of these minds on this. But what I really would like to do is come up with, an idea of how we can, kind of build a new idea. And I know that we've had varying strategies that have been expressed here of what can possibly happen from the LDS Church History Department, which is in a way, in doing this, tried to decide we're going to have all of these primary sources and essentially give them to you entirely unfiltered, to the Community of Christ history, which is denominationally, while maintaining remembering its ministerial role, it seems to, as we heard Mark's presentation, embraced a lot of the ideals of the New Mormon history. And then we have the ideas of what maybe some of the other religious traditions have done in order to construct this. And then John Charles, I think, has said that we probably have continual employment as we continually go back and forth between doing the one and then the other, and we'll go back to the one methodology and go back to the other. So,
okay. Hello. Thanks for a great presentation. And I kind of want to put this out there so it informs the discussion. I'm curious about the notion of, you know, history is really fun because it's controversial. I mean, I just taught Lies My Teacher Told Me. You guys read that book?
Yeah, sure.
To a bunch of high school college sophomores, and they just got lit up, excited about history. But my question is how we teach the... how do you guys approach teaching young LDS students this kind of thing without... I know you brought it up again, but I want to really talk about how do we, these things that can really just destroy someone's idea of the church, you know, Joseph was married to women who had other husbands, and therefore I'm not going to go to church anymore. How can you bring that up and keep the fascination in the history without destroying the faith? I mean, essentially, as an active member, to any other active members in the audience, how do you talk about that stuff in Elders Quorum without getting run out of the Elders Quorum on a rail? And I've seen someone do it. Jonathan Stavely writes for the MHA. He used to be my Elders Quorum president. He could do it. He was really careful. But I wondered if you guys had any ideas on how to talk about that to people who are just being introduced to Mormon history. Get them fascinated with it, warts and all.
Were you addressing to one or anyone in particular? Does somebody want to field it? Morris?
I don't know why I got chosen, but a lawyer can always say something, right? Well, I have taught people on sort of the institute level, and I don't hesitate to bring out these things because I think that if they're very smart, they'll find it on the internet anyway. And I don't hesitate to in high priest quorum because most of them are sleeping and they won't they won't notice it. Sunday school is a little more iffy. I guess that, you know, my feeling is that the truth will out. Now, if you're teaching seminary students, there's so much for them to learn, high school kids. There's so much to learn that's kind of the basic history that I don't know how you have time to get into all the deeper mysteries. But if some student in my class were to say, listen, I was reading the other day where Joseph Smith had a bunch of wives and some of them were already married, I would say, yeah, that's right. Let's talk about that. That's my take on it.
And I guess I would add that for me, as a growing up LDS, and like I say, having had the history that was so dull and on one sided in the way it was, or it, without lacking all of that interest, was one of the, you know, made it not interesting to me. When we were asking the questions, I was reminded that could you identify your name and then ask the question if you want to address it to somebody in particular or just in general.
Okay, Chris Bradford. I have one very brief question for Morris about the intended audience of the Joseph Smith Papers. Is it intended for a scholarly audience for professional historians, or is it intended for a broader audience?
Well, it kind of cuts the line a little bit. It's certainly intended for scholarly historians. I'm just finished reading the book, His Excellency, by Joseph Ellis, about George Washington. And in the very beginning, he says, I really credit the mother lode of all, which is the George Washington Papers. This is why I can write this book in this decade, and they couldn't have written it 30 or 40 years ago because they didn't have those papers. We're hoping that the Joseph Smith Papers will help professional historians get to the mother lode without having to go to libraries all over the country, which is what we've done. Now, how about people like us that maybe aren't considered professional historians? Yes, because all of this explanatory text, the footnotes, the glossaries, etc., is going to help you get right on the ground with the documents. Will you be able to afford 30 volumes? Maybe not, but they'll be in libraries. So I hope that answers the question.
Thanks. One question generally to the group. I wonder about sort of the premise of the panel, which is, what do we need to change about the way we do history? And it seems almost like it's not the history that needs to change so much as it is the faith that needs to change. I think about a relatively recent article by Davis Bitten, who's normally considered one of the new Mormon historians, that is titled, I Don't Have a Testimony of the History of the Church. And essentially what he's trying to do is disconnect the issue of historicity from the faith. It's not changing the way we do history, it's changing the way that we look at faith. And I think Stephen Taysom addressed this a little bit, said it takes a long time to get there, but in today's world with the information explosion and so forth, I wonder if we really do need to wait for that long time.
And this, I mean, this touches on the first question too. I don't have lots of Mormon students in southern Indiana, but I have lots of conservative evangelical students, and the look on the face is the same. When I talk about the four-source hypothesis or the documentary hypothesis or Noah's flood, whatever. Part of it is how much power an institution plans on granting any kind of activity. And historically, the LDS Church, to use a particular example, has granted lots and lots of power to history. So how do you build faith? You tell people stories about the past. The problem is that power, once it is invested in a vehicle like that, is invested in it. And if people start to think about connecting spiritual truths, their testimonies, with stories about the past, and then those stories start to get a little scrambled from what they're used to encountering, guess what? It still has that power. And it exerts an influence on their testimony. So part of the question you're asking is, you have, and this is true of students, how do they respond to it? How can you help them? Much of it depends on what they bring. How intransigent are they about this? I mean, if they're insisting that I teach them that there really was a Moses, that I can prove led the children of Israel, all of them that the Bible says there were, out of Egypt, then there's a problem. There's a disconnect. If they can learn to nuance it somehow, which is part of being educated, there's success. It can't all be on the great minds that are designing, you know, the thing. Part of it is how we teach kids, how children are socialized in homes to teach religion. And sometimes there's no way out of it. There's just going to be that clash.
Thanks.
I want to address this as well, and also taking this opportunity to sort of put on the consultant's cap we were invited to put on. There's a certain kind of religious liberalism which wants to reconcile the faith with modern scholarship. And it seems to me that the way that Mark Scher has described their project is that kind of liberalism. And they want a church story that will have historical integrity, that will be able to stand up to the professional standards of the modern, which is to say naturalistic, academy. I consider myself a religious liberal, but I'm not that kind of liberal. And in that sense, I think I actually kind of agree with Richard Bushman and even Louis Midgley, God forbid, on certain points, which is that I think ultimately faith and scholarship are separate discourses with separate agendas and separate interests and separate criteria. And I think the mixing of the two is kind of a strange endeavor. So, take for example the first vision. I don't believe the first vision. The questions about the historicity of the first vision, did the account evolve, was there actually revival when Joseph said there was, and so on, those questions are not really relevant to what the first vision account means for my faith. Though certainly my understanding of, and my reception to revisionist questionings of the Orthodox account certainly affect my relationship with LDS Orthodoxy, my relationship with the church, so it's not inconsequential to my faith. But in the end, when I embrace the first vision, I don't embrace it as history. I embrace it as a sacred story, which I understand is a form of discourse which is separate from history. Once upon a time, a young boy wanted to know the answer to where to find the truth. And he went into the woods, and he prayed to God about it, and he got an answer. I know that story is true. And I know it's true because it's happened to me. And that's fundamental to my faith. And that's entirely independent of the historical questions that I think Mark is having to wrestle with in creating a church history, because he wants a church history that will meet naturalistic professional standards.
My name is Rob Beckstead. Initially, I'd like to ask Morris a question. I'm sorry, Mark a question. Maybe Morris a response. Implied in a lot of the discussions I've heard on this topic has been the level of activity amongst the young people or people who come across this information, as well as whether or not they continue to affiliate with the organization.
Continue to what?
Continue to affiliate with the organization. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that RLDS and the Community of Christ is an experiment in a historically defensible or a defensible history, mm-hmm. and combining that with faith. So I'm interested in what has happened to activity and numbers, because that seems to be a concern of people in the LDS Church. What will happen to my children? Will they be active? And will they continue to affiliate with this organization?
Well, that's a very, very profound question, and it's something that we're wrestling with at levels much, much higher than mine. I can only tell you the gospel according to Mark. I have two sons at home, but one's 28 and one's 24. And they look to me like a typical son looks to a father for guidance on certain issues, and particularly the church story. If I were to go to them and give them if they were to ask me about the first vision, for example, and they were to ask me, gee, Dad, what happened? And I were to give them the 1842 account, which is standard fare in a lot of places, and then they were to find the 1832 account, and they were to set them together and say, gee, Dad, I thought you said this is what happened, but I discovered that you didn't tell me about this. I've lost something that I cherish with my sons. That's an open, honest communication. Expanding that to the larger Community of Christ setting, I don't know that there's an alternative to do anything other than simply explain, here are the various versions of the account. I totally agree with John Charles about the validity of that experience actually happening, because I had my own grove experience. Actually, it was up in a treehouse. And if my mother wanted to know where I was, she could look up, and I was probably up there. Well, this is exactly what I did. I had my own kinds of experiences. But something that was mentioned earlier about the truth is very elusive, but the truth eventually will come out. It always does. You know, whatever we perceive at the moment to be truth, it's going to come out. And as it relates to how the youth feel about the community of Christ telling them the truth, I don't know that there's an option. I've suggested to you that how we share that with them is very, very important. There is risk, but for me, it's excitement. What calls me into the historical discipline is the excitement of learning and new insights. It's not something that I fear, because I feel that the opposite of fear is knowledge. That's what drives me. That's what causes me to go to work. I just feel that if we're honest, this generation, the rising generation that we've discussed this weekend, wants truth. And if you think for, and if they think for a minute, you're pulling the wool over eyes, the excess will be even faster. It'll accelerate. So I don't know that there's any alternative.
Hi, I'm Claire Barris, and this is for John Charles Duffy. Last week I snuck into a conference at BYU that was intended for members of the Department of Religion and curriculum writers and so forth. It was the end of this, and I was really amazed at what was going on. Richard Bushman had sponsored a seminar through the summer to address the problem. The very problem we're talking about is when history damages faith, the big exodus that is occurring. And these religion people were saying, what can we do? And they decided to write papers to correctly define the events that occurred, that had been occurring in church history. And so I sat there very amazed watching correlation people and so forth deliver papers on the Kinderhook plates and Joseph Smith and his marital relationships. And it was very amazed when these religion people were debating whether or not Joseph Smith was having sex with 14-year-olds and stuff. And I thought, well, where am I at? This is very weird. These guys are doing this. And so I was wondering if you could put that in context. Maybe Bushman seems to be an agent that is maybe trying to get to the people up there in the church office building that maybe we need to be more open and honest. Could you put that in perspective?
What's happening here, and this is something that I talked about also in the Sensen article I did back in 2003 on Defending the Kingdom, Rethinking the Faith. What you're seeing happening is that faithful scholarship, as represented by people like Farms, most notably, but also, you know, this new kind of faithful history, is an endeavor. It moderates Mormon fundamentalism. And when I say Mormon fundamentalism, I'm not talking about the polygamists. I mean this kind of anti-modernism, this diehard scriptural literalism. The kind of traditionalism that people like Leonard Arrington was kind of standing over against, and that Bushman himself is standing over against. People who just want strict, faithful Moroni histories, the kind of people who thought that rough stone rolling was a threat to faith. That kind of fundamentalism within Mormonism is being moderated by the emergence of faithful history. Because faithful history wants an understanding of the faith that will be more rigorous by prevailing academic standards. Which, from my perspective, is a good thing, in the sense that, I mean, I think that's certainly better than fundamentalism. I wish they'd go farther, but they're not going to do that. And so what you're seeing happening is a kind of negotiation. An effort on the part of Orthodox Latter-day Saints, actually, it just occurs to me that in a way kind of similar to the religious liberalism I was just critiquing, in their own way, they're trying to reconcile the two. They want to be able to say, yes, LDS claims about the supernatural and, you know, other kinds of canonical narratives can be historically sound. You know, they wouldn't want to jettison historicity the way I just did, you know, when I was doing the Old Testament a while ago. But they also want to be able to say that it's sound by the criteria that prevail in the academy. Does that make sense? That's what they're trying to do. Yeah, in many ways, I think they've been quite successful at doing it. But in order to do it, what it has meant is that they've had to sort of say, you know what? Certain ways that the saints have traditionally understood their history, we're going to have to let go. Because they don't match up to academic criteria. And that's kind of the very interesting development.
My name is Barry, and this is probably best directed to Stephen and John Charles. Someone had mentioned earlier about different discourses and different epistemologies. And so I guess my question has to do with, could we frame the problem in terms that historians don't, or they do not like how people in religion poach or appropriate history? In other words, you know, leave my history alone because you're contaminating it or you're turning it into something, leave it as it is. And so, I guess, phrased yet another way, are historians trying to control the boundaries of history and how it's used? And that's, and is that what creates the confrontations? Because the people, or the religionists, we'll call them, want to appropriate that history and use it for their own faith-promoting ends. And it seems as though historians are saying, no, you can't do that, right? You're not an historian. You know, you're stepping over my boundaries.
That's part of it. I think, in some sense, most historians who are writing in this, is particularly true of historians of religion, just generally have personality disagreements with religious people writing that kind of history. They just have lots of disagreements about how the world works. Religious studies scholars can't really complain about poaching because we poach from everybody. There's no one religious studies discipline. Methodology, things anthropology, sociology, history, all the rest of it. So I don't think there's any overt argument that this is you shouldn't be encroaching on it. But there are legitimate methodological questions about consistency. And this is why you get this phenomenological argument, okay, which says, well, we just let them speak. Okay, you devise a methodology that is reasonable, and then you only apply it to specific cases. I don't know if that answers. I don't know where he went, so I can't see his.
Absolutely. This is very much about boundary maintenance. This is very much about authority. I mean, what bothers someone like Richard Bushman or Louis Midgley about what they perceive as the adoption of secular criteria by LDS scholars is that it seems that they're selling out in a certain way on what should be distinctive about the Mormon community. They're taking their cues from outside. They're taking their cues from the world rather than taking their cues from, you know, the criteria of the faith. And so certainly it's very much about what is your authority? You know, who are LDS historians going to take their cues from? And what we've had develop is that some historians want to just say, well, let's just assimilate into this naturalistic modern profession and let's take our cues from that. Others want to say, you know, sort of the diehard CES fundamentalists want to say, forget the world, we don't need them, it doesn't matter to us what they think, we're going to defend the faith. And then you have people who are trying to build certain kinds of middle ground positions. The New Mormon history was one kind of middle ground position, didn't succeed in the long run, got squelched. Faithful scholarship is another kind of middle ground position, which seems to be getting a lot more, it seems to be working a lot better, because it allows faithful scholars to feel like they are simultaneously able to function in the faith community, but they are also able to function within outside communities. They're able to sort of, if you want to put it in scriptural terms, in a pejorative way, and this is a little nasty of me, they're trying to serve two masters. And they seem to think they're doing pretty well at it.
But I, just to add to that, there's a hypocrisy about it, because that's the only field where that's a problem is scholarship. Right? I mean, nobody accuses it. So, the example I've used is, if I'm an attorney, and I have a vision that God comes and says, you have to tell the jury to acquit this person because he didn't do it. What happens if I walk into court and say, you have to acquit this person because God told me he didn't do it? Maybe he did tell you that, but you're working in an environment where everybody agrees on the rules before you start. And God telling you what happened isn't part of the way it's structured. Everybody accepts that as perfectly reasonable. Historians say that, and all of a sudden, he has a beard, too. I wonder what else is going on. I mean, all these suspicions, right?
So I just wanted to throw that in. This has been great. Thank you so much, this panel. Oh, Lori Call. It's been fascinating. Recently, I was introduced to Julian of Norwich, who was a Catholic mystic during the medieval time period. And if you read her account, which is quite remarkable, it changes over the 30 years or more where she struggles to write it down. And she's struggling from one account to another account, trying to get to the truthfulness of the experience that she had. And so it doesn't really bother me that there's a couple of accounts of Joseph Smith at all. And it just shows the struggle that a person goes through to try to understand their own experience in their own life.
Well, I'd like to speak to this, and I appreciate this. And there's some irony that we are discussing the first vision. I have the honor of teaching a lot of our field appointee ministers. And in the seminary experience, and of course the subject I teach is church history, and one of the early topics is how to address the issue of the first vision. Well, I went through an explanation. I laid out the six different visions, accounts of the vision, and so on. And I could really tell, reading the audience, I could read in my class, that I was really, some of them were really disconsolate. This had destroyed their visage of what actually happened. So I felt kind of bad about that, and it occurred to me on the way home that I needed to do something about this. So I had one of these wee early more hours in the morning type of experiences. Gosh, you know what I ought to do? I ought to go to a florist's shop. And I went, and I had 12 students in the class. They were all Mission Center, just about all Mission Center presidents and so on. That's pretty high ranking, I suppose, in the hierarchy. And so I passed out a rose to each person. And they thought, well, this is Mark trying to make, trying to make good and to kind of heal the wounds that I had inflicted the day before. So I said, okay, here's what I want you to do. I want you to take a sniff of this rose that's in front of you. And then over the next 5 minutes, I want you to describe it. So very obediently, they all got their pencils and papers and so on. They took sniffs and they started, they started writing. After about 3 minutes, nobody was writing. Everybody was just kind of befuddled as to how to deal with this, which proved my point exactly. Because this is what Joseph Smith encountered in the Grove. How do you put human words to describe a divine event? What happens in an event when the words can't describe it? Which is, I think, is essentially what this person was encountering. And so when they started to sniff, they didn't have the words to describe the fragrance. And it made maybe the first vision come a little more clear as to why he explained things so differently in his 1832 account. Why he writes 10 years later, you wonder if it's even describing the same event. And so sometimes words just can't, the human experience cannot comprehend fully the divine experience. I hope that helps.
Chris Bradford, a question for John Charles. I wonder how much of what we see over the course of Mormon history with the various new Mormon history movements, faithful history, and so forth, is sort of a natural consequence of religious tradition as they develop, interactions with the greater, culture, social movements, information, availability, and so forth. And therefore, whether we really need to put a lot of conscious effort into how we do history, or whether it's just something that kind of happens because of the way society moves and the previous things that occur.
That's an interesting question. I'm answering off the cuff here, so don't hold me to this. I might answer differently 10 minutes from now. But my gut reaction at this point is to say, I'm resisting the idea that it just kind of happens naturally. I don't know. I want to be able to sort of pinpoint political processes. And what I would say is what we're seeing happening is certainly a question of negotiating relationships with other social sectors, particularly in this case the academy, since that's kind of the crucial one. And yeah, there are definitely historical and sociological factors that are making this issue play out the way it is at this time. The emergence, the expansion of higher education in the 60s, Mormons participating in that. The way that the intellectual politics of Mormonism have played out, which are not just the process of natural growth. I mean, it has to do with, in the 80s, certain things are happening in the discipline of history, which are spilling over into the Mormon history wars. And in the early 90s, I have theorized that even things like Benson's incapacitation and the anxieties that creates in tandem with the New World Order and the fall of communism are helping to lead to the September 6th. There are very historically specific things that are happening that cause this to work out in different ways. But certainly, yes, it is all about how we're negotiating our relationship to other social sectors. And that's a consequential question. That doesn't matter. What is Mormonism going to be like? What is it going to be its relationship to other sectors in our society that profess to be able to declare what is true? That's a very important question.
Well, we are right around the end of our time, and boy, I want to thank everybody. I want to thank all of our panelists for bringing all of those thoughts to bear, and all of you for participating.